religion at one extreme and a conspiracy of priests at the other extreme, and permitting us to consider much more interesting and more probable accounts of how and why religions evolve. Evolutionary theory is not a one-trick pony, and when the Martians set out to theorize about earthly religion, they have lots of options to explore, which I will swiftly sketch in extreme versions, just to give a sense of the terrain to be explored more carefully in later chapters. Sweet tooth theories. First, consider the variety of things we like to ingest or otherwise insert into our bodies. Sugar, fat, alcohol, caffeine, chocolate, nicotine, marijuana, and opium for a start. In each case, there is an evolved receptor system in the body designed to detect substances, either ingested or constructed within the body, such as the endorphins or endogenously created morphine analogs, that these favorites have in high concentration. Over the ages, our clever species has gone prospecting, sampling just about everything in the environment. And after millennia of trial and error has managed to discover ways of gathering and concentrating these special substances so that we can use them to overstimulate our innate systems. The Martians may wonder if there are also genetically evolved systems in our bodies that are designed to respond to something that religions provide in intensified form. Many have thought so. Karl Marx may have been more right than he knew when he called religion the opiate of the masses. Might we have a God center in our brains along with our sweet tooth? What would it be for? What would pay for it? As Richard Dawkins puts it, if neuroscientists find a God center in the brain, Darwinian scientists like me want to know why the God center evolved. Why did those of our ancestors who had a genetic tendency to grow a God center survive better than rivals who did not? 2004b, page 14. If any such evolutionary account is correct, then those with a God center not only survived better than those without one, they tended to have more offspring. But we should carefully set aside the anachronism involved in thinking of this hypothesized innate system as a God center, since its original target may have been quite unlike the intense stuff that turns it on today. We don't have an innate chocolate ice cream center in the brain after all, or a nicotine center. God may just be the latest and most intense confection that triggers the what-sis center in so many people. What benefit accrued to those who satisfied their what-sis craving? It could even be that there isn't and never has been any actual target in the world to obtain, but just an imaginary or virtual target in effect. It's been the seeking, not the getting, that has had a fitness advantage. In any case, if the need, or at least the taste, for this still unidentified treasure has become a genetically transmitted part of human nature, we tamper with it at our peril. Theories in this family raise some interesting possibilities. Both sugar and saccharin trigger our sweet tooth system. Are there religion substitutes to be found or concocted by clever psychoengineers? Or, even more interesting, are religions themselves a kind of saccharin for the brain, less filling or debilitating or intoxicating than the original and potentially harmful target? Is religion itself a subspecies of folk medicine, in which we self-medicate for relief, using therapies honed by thousands of years of trial and error development? Is there genetic variation in religious sensitivity, like the huge genetic variation recently discovered among human beings in taste and olfaction? Those of us who can't stand cilantro have a gene for an olfactory receptor that cilantro lovers don't share. Cilantro tastes rather like soap to us. William James speculated 100 years ago that he, but not everybody, had a brute need for religion. Call this, if you like, my mystical germ. It is a very common germ. It creates the rank and file of believers. As it withstands in my case, so it will withstand in most cases all purely atheistic criticism. Letter to Liuba, quoted in Introduction to James 1902, page 24. James's mystical germ might actually be a mystical gene. Or it might be, just as he said, a mystical germ, something that spread from person to person, not vertically, by descent from parents, but horizontally, by infection. symbiont theories. Religions might turn out to be species of cultural symbionts that manage to thrive by leaping from human host to human host. They may be mutualists, enhancing human fitness and even making human life possible, just as the bacteria in our gut do. Or commensals. Neutral, neither good for us nor bad for us, but along for the ride. Or they might be parasites. Deleterious replicators that we would be better off without, at least so far as our genetic interests are concerned, but that are hard to eliminate since they have evolved so well to counter our defenses and enhance their own propagation. We can expect that cultural parasites, like microbial parasites, exploit whatever pre-existing systems come in handy. The sneezing reflex, for instance, is in the first place an adaptation for ridding the nasal passages of foreign irritants. But when a germ provokes sneezing, it is typically not the sneezer but the germ that is the principal beneficiary, getting a high-energy launching into a neighborhood where other potential hosts can take it in. Spreading germs and spreading memes may exploit similar mechanisms, such as irresistible urges to impart stories or other items of information to others, enhanced by traditions that heighten the length, intensity, and frequency of encounters with others who might be likely hosts. When we look at religion from this perspective, the cui bono question changes dramatically. Now it is not our fitness, as reproducing members of the species Homo sapiens, that is presumed to be enhanced by religion, but its fitness, as a reproducing, self-replicating, member of the symbiont genus Cultus religiosus. It may thrive as a mutualist because it benefits its host quite directly. Or it may thrive as a parasite, even though it oppresses its hosts with a virulent affliction that leaves them worse off but too weak to combat its spread. And the main point to get clear about at the outset is that we can't tell which of these is more likely to be true without doing careful, objective research. Your religion probably seems obviously benign to you, and other religions may well seem to you to be just as obviously toxic to those infected by them. But appearances can deceive. Perhaps their religion is providing them with benefits that you just don't understand yet. And perhaps your religion is poisoning you in ways that you have never suspected. You really can't tell from the inside. That's how parasites work. Quietly, unobtrusively, without disturbing their hosts any more than is absolutely necessary. If some religions are culturally evolved parasites, we can expect them to be insidiously well-designed to conceal their true nature from their hosts, since this is an adaptation that would further their own spread. These two families of theories, sweet tooth and symbiont, are not exclusive. As we have already seen with the example of the alcohol-excreting yeast, there are symbiotic possibilities that may combine several of these phenomena together. It may be that an initial craving is exploited by cultural symbionts that include both mutualist and parasitical forms. A relatively benign or harmless symbiont may mutate under some conditions into something virulent and even deadly. For millennia, people have imagined that other religions might be a form of disease or sickness, and apostates often look back on their earlier days as a period of affliction, which they have somehow survived. But the evolutionary perspective allows us to see that there are just as many positive as negative scenarios once we start looking at religion as possibly a cultural symbiont. Friendly symbionts are everywhere. Your body is composed of perhaps 100 trillion cells, and 9 out of 10 of them are not human cells. Hooper et al., 1998. Most of these trillions of microscopic guests are either harmless or helpful. Only a minority are worth worrying about. Many of them indeed are valuable helpers that we inherit from our mothers and would be quite defenseless without. These inheritances are not genetic. Some of them may be passed on via the shared bloodstream of mother and fetus, but others are picked up by bodily contact or proximity. A surrogate mother who makes no genetic contribution to the fetus implanted in her womb nevertheless makes a major contribution to the microflora that the infant will carry with it for the rest of its life. Cultural symbionts, memes, are similarly passed on to one's offspring by non-genetic pathways. Speaking one's mother tongue, singing, being polite, and many other socializing skills are transmitted culturally from parents to offspring. And infant human beings deprived of these sources of inheritance are often profoundly disabled. It is well known that the parent-offspring link is the major pathway of transmission of religion. Children grow up speaking their parents' language and, in almost all cases, identifying with their parents' religion. Religion, not being genetic, can be spread horizontally to non-descendants, but such conversions play a negligible role under most circumstances. A dim appreciation of this has led in the past to some crude and cruel programs of hygiene. If you think that religion is, all things considered, a malignant feature of human culture, a childhood disease of sorts with lingering after effects, the public health policy to deal with it would be politically drastic, but quite simple. Inoculation and isolation. Don't let parents give their own children a religious upbringing. This policy has been tried on a major scale in the former Soviet Union, with dire consequences. The rebound of religion in post-USSR Russia suggests that religion has roles to play and resources undreamt of by this simple vision. A completely different sort of evolutionary possibility is represented by sexual selection theories. Perhaps religion is like a bowerbird's bower. Male bowerbirds devote extraordinary time and effort to building and decorating elaborate structures designed to impress females of the species, who choose a mate only after assessing rival bowers carefully. This is an example of runaway sexual selection, the subvariety of natural selection in which the pivotal selective role is played by the choosy female, whose preferences may, over many generations, snowball into highly specific and onerous demands, such as the whims of peahens that oblige peacocks to grow spectacular and spectacularly expensive and awkward tails. See Cronin, 1991, for a fine overview. The bright coloration of male birds is the best studied example of sexual selection. In these cases, an initial bias in the innate whims of females, such as a preference for blue over yellow, gets amplified by positive feedback into intensely blue males, the bluer the better. Had a majority of the females in an isolated population of the species just happened to prefer yellow over blue, the runaway selection would have ended up with bright yellow males. There is nothing in the environment that makes yellow better than blue or vice versa, except for the reigning taste of the species' females, which exerts a powerful, if arbitrary, selection pressure. How might something like the runaway sexual selection process shape the extravagances of religion? In several ways. First, there might have been straightforward sexual selection by human females for religion-enhancing psychological traits. Perhaps they preferred males who demonstrated a sensitivity to music and ceremony, which could then have snowballed into a proclivity for elaborate rapture. The females who had this preference wouldn't have had to understand why they had it. It could just have been a whim, a blind personal taste that prompted them to choose. But if the mates they chose just happened to be better providers, more faithful family men, these mothers and fathers would tend to raise more children and grandchildren than others. And both the sensitivity to ceremony and the taste for those who loved ceremony would spread. Or the same whim could have had a selective advantage only because more females shared that whim, so that sons who lacked the fashionable sensitivity to ceremony were passed over by the choosy females. And if an influential sample of our female ancestors had happened, for no good reason, to have a taste for males who jumped up and down in the rain, we guys would now find ourselves unable to sit still whenever it rained. Girls might or might not share our tendency to jump under these conditions, but they would definitely go for the guys who did. That is the implication of the classic sexual selection hypothesis. The idea that musical talent is the royal road to the embrace of a woman is certainly familiar. It probably sells a million guitars a year. And there may well be something to it. This could be a genetically transmitted proclivity, with significant variation in the population, but we should also consider cultural analogs of sexual selection. The potlatch ceremonies found among the Native Americans of the Northwest are striking. ceremonial demonstrations of conspicuous generosity, in which individuals compete with one another to see who can give away the most, sometimes to the point of ruin. These customs bear the marks of having been created by a positive feedback escalator like those that establish peacock tails and giant Irish elk antlers. Other social phenomena also exhibit inflationary spirals of expensive and essentially arbitrary competition. Tail fins on cars of the 1950s, teenagers' fashions, and outdoor lighting displays at Christmas are among those most often discussed, but there are others as well. For more than a million years, our ancestors made beautiful Acheulean hand axes, pear-shaped stone implements of varying size, lovingly finished and seldom showing any sign of wear and tear. Clearly, our ancestors spent a lot of time and energy making these, and the design hardly changed over the eons. Large caches of hundreds and even thousands of these have been found. Mithen, 1996. The archaeologist Thomas Wynne, 1995, has opined that it would be difficult to overemphasize just how strange the hand axe is when compared to the products of modern culture. They're biofacts, said one archaeologist, coining a new term, and inspiring the science writer Merrick Cohn, 1999, to come up with a striking hypothesis. Geofacts are what archaeologists call stones that look like artifacts but aren't. They are just the unintended product of some geological process. Cohn proposes that these hand axes may not be artifacts so much as biofacts, more like a bower bird's bower than a hunter's bow and arrow, conspicuously expensive advertisements of male superiority. A ploy that was transmitted culturally, not genetically, in a tradition that dominated the battle of the sexes for a million years. The hominoids who worked so hard to participate in this competition no more needed to understand the rationale of the enterprise than do the male spiders who catch an insect and wrap it neatly in silk to present as a nuptial gift to females during courtship. This is a highly speculative and controversial claim, but it is not yet disproven, and it usually alerts us to the possibilities that might otherwise elude us. Whatever the reasons for it, our ancestors lavished time and effort on apparently unused artifacts whenever they could, a precedent worth remembering when we marvel at the expensive tombs, temples, and sacrifices. The interplay of cultural and genetic transmission should also be explored. Consider the well-studied case of lactose tolerance in adults, for instance. Many of us adults can drink and digest raw milk without difficulty, but many others, who of course had no difficulty consuming milk when they were babies, can no longer digest milk after infancy, since their bodies switch off the gene for making lactase, the necessary enzyme after they are weaned, which is the normal pattern in mammals. Who is lactose tolerant and who isn't? There is a clear pattern discernible to geneticists. Lactose tolerance is concentrated in human populations that have descended from dairying cultures, whereas lactose intolerance is common in those whose ancestors were never herders of dairy animals, such as the Chinese and Japanese. Lactose tolerance is genetically transmitted, but pastoralism, the disposition to tend herds of animals on which the genetic trait depends, is culturally transmitted. Presumably it could have been genetically transmitted, but so far as we know, it hasn't been. Border collies, unlike the children of Basque shepherds, have had herding instincts bred into them, after all. Dennett, 2003, C.D. Then there are money theories, according to which religions are cultural artifacts rather like monetary systems. Communally developed systems that have evolved culturally several times. Their presence in every culture is readily explained and even justified. It's a good trick that one would expect to be rediscovered again and again. A case of convergent social evolution. Cui bono? Who benefits? Here we can consider several answers. A. Everybody in the society benefits, because religion makes life in society more secure, harmonious, efficient. Some benefit more than others, but nobody would be wise to wish the whole thing away. B. The elite who control the system benefit at the expense of the others. Religion is more like a pyramid scheme than a monetary system. It thrives by preying on the ill-informed and powerless, while its beneficiaries pass it along gladly to their heirs, genetic or cultural. C. Societies as wholes benefit. Whether or not the individuals benefit, the perpetuation of their social or political groups is enhanced, at the expense of rival groups. This last hypothesis, group selection, is tricky, since the conditions under which genuine group selection can exist are hard to specify. The schooling of fish and flocking of birds, for instance, are certainly phenomena involving grouping, but they are not explained as group selection phenomena. In order to see how individuals, or their individual genes, are benefited by the dispositions to school or flock, you have to understand the ecology of groups. But the groups aren't the primary beneficiaries. The individuals that compose them are. Some biological phenomena masquerade as group selection but are better dealt with as instances of individual-level selection that depend on certain environmental phenomena, such as grouping, or even as instances of symbiont selection phenomena. As we have already noted, a symbiont meme needs to be spread to new hosts. And if it can drive people into groups, the way Toxoplasma gondii drives rats into the jaws of cats, where it can readily find alternate hosts, the explanation is not group selection after all. If the Martians can't make any of these theories fit the facts, they should consider a default theory of sorts that we may call the Pearl Theory. Religion is simply a beautiful byproduct. It is created by a genetically controlled mechanism or family of mechanisms that are meant, by Mother Nature or evolution, to respond to irritations or intrusions of one sort or another. These mechanisms were designed by evolution for certain purposes, but then one day along comes something novel, or a novel convergence of different factors, something never before encountered, and of course never foreseen by evolution, that happens to trigger the activities that generate this amazing artifact. According to Pearl theories, religion isn't for anything from the point of view of biology. It doesn't benefit any gene or individual or group or cultural symbiont. But once it exists, it can be an objet trouvé, something that just happens to captivate us human agents, who have an indefinitely expandable capacity for delighting in novelties and curiosities. A pearl begins with a meaningless speck of foreign matter, or, more likely, a parasite, and once the oyster has added layer after beautiful layer, it can become something of coincidental value to members of a species who just happen to prize such things, whether or not this coveting is wise from the point of view of biological fitness. There are other standards of value that may emerge for reasons good or bad, free-floating or highly articulated. In much the way the oyster responds to the initial irritant and then incessantly responds to the results of its first response, and then to the results of that response, and so on, human beings may be unable to leave off reacting to their own reactions, incorporating ever more elaborate layers into a production that then takes on shapes and features unimaginable from its modest beginnings. What explains religion? Sweet tooth, symbiont, bower, money, pearl, or none of the above? Religion may include phenomena of human culture that have no remote analog in genetic evolution. But if so, we will still have to answer the cui bono question, because it is undeniable that the phenomena of religion are designed to a very significant degree. There are few signs of randomness or arbitrariness, so some differential replication has to pay for the R&D responsible for the design. These hypotheses do not all pull in the same direction, but the truth about religion might well be an amalgam of several of them, plus others. If this is so, we will not get a clear vision of why religion exists until we have clearly distinguished these possibilities and put each of them to the test. If you think you already know which theory is right, you are either a major scientist who has been concealing a vast mountain of unpublished research from the rest of the world, or else you are confusing wishful thinking with knowledge. Perhaps it seems to you that I am somewhat willfully ignoring the obvious explanation of why your religion exists and has the features it does. It exists because it is the inevitable response of enlightened human beings to the obvious fact that God exists. Some would add, we engage in these religious practices because God commands us to do so, or because it pleases us to please God. End of story. But that could not be the end of the story. Whichever religion is yours, there are more people in the world who don't share it than who do. and it falls to you, to all of us, really, to explain why so many have gotten it wrong, and to explain how those who know, if there are any, have managed to get it right. Even if it is obvious to you, it isn't obvious to everyone or even to most people. If you have come this far in the book, you are willing to inquire into the sources and causes of other religions. Wouldn't it be hypocritical to claim that your own religion was somehow out of bounds? Just to satisfy your own intellectual curiosity, you might wish to see how your own religion measures up to the sort of scrutiny we will be directing at others. But, you may well wonder, can science be truly nonpartisan? Isn't science, in fact, just another religion? Or, to put it the other way around, aren't religious perspectives just as valid as the scientific perspective? How can we find any common objective ground from which to conduct our inquiries? These questions concern many readers, especially academics who have invested heavily in the answers to them. But others, I find, are impatient with them and not all that concerned. The questions are indeed important. Indeed, crucial to my whole project, since they put into doubt the very possibility of conducting the inquiry I am embarking on. But they can be postponed until after the theory sketch is completed. If you disagree, then before continuing with Chapter 4, you should turn directly to Appendix B, Some More Questions About Science, which deals with these questions, spelling out in more detail, and defending, the path by which we can work together to find mutual agreement about how to proceed and what matters. Chapter 3. Everything we value, from sugar and sex and money to music and love and religion, we value for reasons. Lying behind and distinct from our reasons are evolutionary reasons, free-floating rationales that have been endorsed by natural selection. Chapter 4. Like all animal brains, human brains have evolved to deal with the specific problems of the environments in which they must operate. The social and linguistic environment that co-evolved with human brains gives human beings power that no other species enjoys, but also creates problems that folk religions apparently evolved to handle. The apparent extravagance of religious practices can be accounted for in the austere terms of evolutionary biology. Part 2. The Evolution of Religion. Chapter 4. The Roots of Religion. 1. The Births of Religions. Everything is what it is because it got that way. D'Arcy Thompson. Among Hindus, there is disagreement over whether Shiva or Vishnu is the higher lord, and many have been killed for their belief in this matter. The Linga Purana promises Siva's heaven to one who kills or tears out the tongue of someone who reviles Siva. Klostermeyer, 1994. Among the Zulus, when a pregnant woman is about to give birth, sometimes the spirit snake of an old woman makes an angry appearance, according to the shamans, indicating that a goat or some other animal should be sacrificed to the tribe's ancestors so that the child may be born healthy. Lawson and Macaulay, 1990, page 116. The Jivaro of Ecuador believe that you have three souls. The true soul you have from birth. It returns to your birthplace when you die, then turns into a demon, which dies in turn, becoming a giant moth, which becomes mist when it dies. The Arutam, a soul you obtain by fasting, bathing in a waterfall, and partaking of hallucinogenic juice. It makes you invincible, but has the unfortunate habit of leaving you when you're in a jam. And the Musiak, the avenging soul, which tries to escape a victim's head and kill the victim's murderer. This is why you must shrink the head of your victim. Harris, 1993. These curious beliefs and practices have not existed forever, no matter what their devotees may say. Marcel Gauchet begins his book on the political history of religion by noting, "As far as we know, religion has without exception existed at all times and in all places," 1997, page 22. But this is a historian's pinched perspective and simply isn't true. There was a time before religious beliefs and practices had occurred to anyone. There was a time, after all, before there were any believers on the planet, before there were any beliefs about anything. Some religious beliefs are truly ancient by historical standards, and the advent of others can be read about in newspaper archives. How did they all arise? Sometimes the answer seems obvious enough, especially when we have reliable historical records from the recent past. When Europeans in their magnificent sailing ships first visited the islands of the South Pacific in the 18th century, the Melanesians living on these islands were awestruck by these vessels and by the remarkable gifts they were given by the white men who lived in them. Steel tools and bolts of cloth and glass you could see through, and other cargo beyond their ken. They reacted much as we would probably react today if visitors from outer space showed up capable of overwhelming us at will and bearing technologies we hadn't even dreamt of. We must get ourselves some of this cargo and learn how to harness the magical powers of these visitors. And our puny efforts to use what we did know to take control of the situation and restore our security and sense of power would probably amuse these technologically superior aliens as much as we are amused by the Melanesians' conclusion that the Europeans must be their ancestors in disguise, coming back from the realm of the dead with untold wealth, demigods to be worshipped. When Lutheran missionaries arrived in Papua New Guinea in the late 19th century to try to convert the Melanesians to Christianity, they met stubborn suspicion. Why were these stingy ancestors in disguise withholding the cargo and trying to make them sing hymns? Cargo cults have sprung up again and again in the Pacific. During World War II, American forces arrived at the island of Tanna to recruit 1,000 men to help build an airfield and army base on neighboring Efate Island. When the workers returned with tales of white and black men who had possessions beyond the dreams of the people of Tanna, the whole society was thrown into turmoil. The islanders, many of whom had earlier been converted to Christianity by British missionaries, stopped going to church and began to build landing strips, warehouses, and radio masts out of bamboo, in the belief that if it worked on Efate for the Americans, it would work for them on Tanna. Carved figurines of American warplanes, helmets and rifles were made from bamboo and used as religious icons. Islanders began to march in parades with USA painted, carved, or tattooed on their chests and backs. John Frum emerged as the name of their messiah, although there are no records of an American soldier with that name. When the last American GI left at the end of the war, the islanders predicted John Frum's return. The movement continued to flourish, and on 15 February 1957, an American flag was raised in Sulphur Bay to declare the religion of John Frum. It is on this date every year that John Frum Day is celebrated. They believe that John Frum is waiting in the volcano Yasser with his warriors to deliver his cargo to the people of Tanna. During the festivities, the elders march in an imitation army, a kind of military drill mixed with traditional dancing. Some carry imitation rifles made of bamboo and wear American Army memorabilia such as caps, T-shirts, and coats. They believe that their annual rituals will draw the god John Frum down from the volcano and deliver the cargo of prosperity to all of the islanders. Mott Dock, 2004. Still more recently, around 1960, on New Britain Island in Papua New Guinea, the Pomeo Kivung cult was founded. It still flourishes. Pomeo Kivung doctrine holds that adherence to the 10 Laws, a modified version of the Decalogue, 10 Commandments, and the faithful performance of an extensive set of rituals, including the payment of fines for the purpose of gaining absolution, are essential to the moral and spiritual improvement that is necessary to hasten the return of the ancestors. The most important of these rituals aims at placating the ancestors who make up the so-called village government. Headed by God, the village government includes those ancestors whom God has forgiven and perfected. The spiritual leaders of the Pomeo Kivung have been its founder Koryam, his principal assistant Bernard, and Koryam's successor Coleman. Followers have regarded all three as already members of the village government and hence as divinities. All three have resided on Earth physically, specifically in the Pomeo region of the province, but their souls have dwelt with the ancestors all along. Achieving sufficient collective purification is the decisive condition for inducing the return of the ancestors and inaugurating the period of the companies. The period of the companies will be an era of unprecedented prosperity, which will result from the transfer of knowledge and an industrial infrastructure for the production of technological wonders and material wealth like that of the Western world. Lawson and Cawley, 2002, page 90. These cases may be exceptional. Your religion, you may believe, came into existence when its fundamental truth was revealed by God to somebody, who then passed it along to others. It flourishes today because you and the others of your faith know that it is the truth, and God has blessed you and encouraged you to keep the faith. It is as simple as that for you. And why do all the other religions exist? If those people are just wrong, why don't their creeds crumble as readily as false ideas about farming or obsolete building practices? They will crumble in due course, you may think, leaving only true religion, your religion, standing. Certainly there is some reason to believe this. In addition to the few dozen major religions in the world today, those whose adherents number in the hundreds of thousands or millions, there are thousands of less populous religions recognized. Two or three religions come into existence every day, and their typical lifespan is less than a decade. There is no way of knowing how many distinct religions have flourished for a while during the last 10 or 50 or 100,000 years, but it might even be millions, of which all traces are now lost forever. Some religions have confirmed histories dating back for several millennia, but only if we are generous with our boundaries. The Mormon Church is less than 200 years old, as its official name reminds us. The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. Protestantism is less than 500 years old. Islam is less than 1,500 years old. Christianity is less than 2,000 years old. Judaism is not even twice as old as that, and the Judaisms of today have evolved significantly from the earliest identifiable Judaism. Though the varieties of Judaism are as nothing compared with the riotous blossoming of variations that Christianity has spawned in the last two millennia. These are short periods of time, biologically speaking. They are not even long compared with the ages of other features of human culture. Writing is more than 5,000 years old, agriculture is more than 10,000 years old, and languages, who knows, maybe only 40,000 years old, and maybe 10 or 20 times older than that. It's a contentious research topic, and since it's widely agreed that fully articulated natural languages must have developed out of some kind of proto-languages, which may have evolved over hundreds of thousands of years, there is no consensus about what would even count as the birth date of language. Is language older than religion? However we date its beginnings, language is much, much older than any existing religion, or even any religion of which we have any historical or archaeological knowledge. The earliest impressive archaeological evidence of religion is the elaborate Cro-Magnon burial sites in the Czech Republic, and they are about 25,000 years old. It is hard to tell, but something like religion may well have existed from the early days of language, however, or even before that. What were our ancestors like before there was anything like religion? Were they like bands of chimpanzees? What, if anything, did they talk about aside from food and predators and the mating game, the weather, gossip? What were the psychological and cultural soil in which religion first took root? We can tentatively work backward, extrapolating under the guidance of our fundamental biological constraint. Each innovative step had to pay for itself somehow in the existing environment in which it first occurred, independently of whatever its role might become in later environments. What then could explain both the diversity and the similarities in the religious ideas we observe around the world? Are the similarities due to the fact that all religious ideas spring from a common ancestor idea, passed on over the generations as people spread around the globe? Or are such ideas independently rediscovered by just about every culture because they are simply the truth, and obvious enough to occur to people in due course? These are obviously naive oversimplifications, but at least they are attempts to ask and answer explicit questions often left unexamined by people who lose interest once they have found a purpose or function for religion that strikes them as plausible. responding to a suitably grand human need to account for the manifest outlay of time and energy that religion requires. The three favorite purposes, or raison d'etre for religion, are to comfort us in our suffering and allay our fear of death, to explain things we can't otherwise explain, to encourage group cooperation in the face of trials and enemies. Thousands of books and articles have been written defending these claims, and such compelling and familiar ideas are probably at least partly right. But if you settle for one of them, or even all three taken together, you succumb to a disorder often encountered in the humanities and social sciences. Premature curiosity satisfaction. There is so much more to ask about and so much more to understand. Why would these ideas comfort people? And why are they comforting, exactly? Might there be better, more comforting ideas to be found? Why would these ideas appeal to people as explanations of baffling events? And how could they have arisen? Did some would-be proto-scientist hit upon a supernatural theory and enthusiastically proselytize her neighbors? How do these ideas actually manage to enhance cooperation in the face of suspicion and defection? And once more, how could they have arisen? Did some wise tribal leader invent religion to give her tribe a teamwork edge over the rival tribes? Some people suppose that we can never do better than such simple speculations about these processes and outcomes from the remote past. Some insist on it, in fact, and their vehemence betrays the fact that they are afraid they are wrong. They are. Today, thanks to advances in a variety of sciences, we can sharpen the questions and begin to answer them. In this and the next four chapters, I will try to tell the best current version of the story science can tell about how religions have become what they are. I am not at all claiming that this is what science has already established about religion. The main point of this book is to insist that we don't yet know, but we can discover the answers to these important questions if we make a concerted effort. Probably some of the features of the story I tell will prove in due course to be mistaken. Maybe many of them are wrong. The purpose of trying to sketch a whole story now is to get something on the table that is both testable and worth testing. It is usually easier to fix something that has flaws than to build something from scratch. Trying to bridge the gaps in our knowledge forces us to frame questions we haven't framed before, and puts the issues in a perspective that enables further questions to be posed and answered. And that in itself can undercut the defeatist proclamation that these are mysteries beyond all human comprehension. Many people may wish that these were unanswerable questions. Let's see what happens when we defy their defensive pessimism and give it a try. 2. The raw materials of religion. We may conclude, therefore, that in all nations which have embraced polytheism, the first ideas of religion arose not from a contemplation of the works of nature, but from a concern with regard to the events of life, and from the incessant hopes and fears which actuate the human mind. David Hume, The Natural History of Religion. My guides are the pioneering scientists who have begun to tackle these questions with both imagination and discipline. An evolutionary biologist or a psychologist who knows only one religion at all well and has a smattering of misinformation about the others, like most of us, is almost certain to overgeneralize from idiosyncratic familiarity when it comes to framing questions. A social historian or an anthropologist who knows a great deal about the beliefs and practices of people all around the world, but is naive about evolution, is equally unlikely to frame the issues well. Fortunately, a few well-informed researchers have recently begun to pull these distant perspectives together, with tantalizing results. Their books and articles are well worth reading in their entirety, as I hope I will convince you by introducing a few highlights. Jared Diamond's Guns, Germs, and Steel, 1997, is an eye-opening exploration of very specific effects of geography and biology on the early development of agriculture in different parts of the world at different times. When the first agriculturalists domesticated animals, they naturally began living in close proximity to them, and this enhanced the likelihood of species jumping by the animals' parasites. The most serious infectious diseases known to humanity, such as smallpox and influenza, all derive from domesticated animals, and our farming ancestors lived through a horrific pruning in which untold millions succumbed to early versions of these diseases, leaving only those fortunate enough to have some natural immunity to reproduce. Many generations of this evolutionary bottleneck guaranteed that their later descendants would be relatively immune to, or have a high tolerance for, the descendants of those virulent strains of parasite. When these grand offspring, living mainly in Europe, developed the technology to cross the oceans, they brought their germs with them. And it was the germs, more than the guns and steel, that wiped out large fractions of the indigenous populations they encountered. The role of agriculture in spawning infectious diseases and the relative immunity to them that had evolved among the peoples who had lived through the ravages of the early days of agriculture can be studied with some precision now that we can extrapolate backward from the genomes of existing species of plants, animals, and germs. Accidents of geography gave European nations a head start. That goes a long way to explain why they were the colonizers rather than the colonized in later centuries. Diamond's Pulitzer Prize-winning book is deservedly well-known, but not alone. There is a new generation of interdisciplinary researchers working to put together the biology with the evidence gleaned by centuries of work by historians, anthropologists, and archaeologists. Pascal Boyer and Scott Atran are anthropologists who have done extensive fieldwork in Africa and Asia, but who are also trained in evolutionary theory and cognitive psychology. Their recent books, Religion Explained, The Evolutionary Origins of Religious Thought, Boyer 2001, and In Gods We Trust, Atran 2002, develop largely harmonious accounts of the major steps into the swamp that they and others have been taking. Then there is David Sloan Wilson, an evolutionary biologist who has been devoting himself in recent years to analyses that systematically exploit the Human Relations Area File, a database of all the world's cultures, compiled by anthropologists. His recent book, Darwin's Cathedral, Evolution, Religion, and the Nature of Society, 2002, makes the best case to date for the hypothesis that religion is a social phenomenon designed, by evolution, to improve cooperation within, not among, human groups. According to Wilson, religion emerged by a process of group selection, a controversial wrinkle in evolutionary theory that is dismissed by many evolutionary theorists as at best a marginal process whose conditions for success are unlikely to arise and persist for long. There are deep reasons to be skeptical about group selection, especially in our species, and precisely because Wilson's thesis, religion as a cooperation enhancer, is deeply attractive to many people, we need to brace ourselves to avoid wishful thinking. It is quite generally agreed among his critics that he has not yet succeeded in making the case for his radical thesis of group selection. But even a roundly refuted scientific theory can make a major contribution to the steady accumulation of scientific understanding if the evidence marshaled for and against it has been scrupulously gathered. For more on this point, see Appendix B. Here I will introduce the main points of agreement, as well as acknowledging the continuing points of contention, packing off most of the controversial details into the endnotes and appendixes, where those with a taste for them can begin to pursue their own deeper consideration of them. Both Boyer and Atran present the work of a small but growing community of researchers in relatively accessible terms. Their central thesis is that in order to explain the hold that various religious ideas and practices have on people, we need to understand the evolution of the human mind. For many centuries, most philosophers and theologians contended that the human mind, or soul, was an immaterial, incorporeal thing, what René Descartes called a res cognitans, thinking thing. It was in some sense infinite, immortal, and utterly inexplicable by material means. We now understand that the mind is not, as Descartes confusedly supposed, in communication with the brain in some miraculous way. It is the brain, or more specifically, a system or organization within the brain that has evolved in much the way our immune system or respiratory system or digestive system has evolved. Like many other natural wonders, the human mind is something of a bag of tricks, cobbled together over the eons by the foresightless process of evolution by natural selection. Driven by the demands of a dangerous world, It is deeply biased in favor of noticing the things that mattered most to the reproductive success of our ancestors. Some of the features of our minds are endowments we share with much simpler creatures, and others are specific to our lineage, and hence much more recently evolved. These features sometimes overshoot, sometimes have curious byproducts, sometimes are ripe for exploitation by other replicators. Of all the quirky effects generated by the whole bag of tricks, our set of gadgets, as Boyer calls them, a few happen to interact with one another in mutually reinforcing ways, creating patterns observable in all cultures, with interesting variations. Some of these patterns look rather like religions, or pseudo-religions, or proto-religions. The byproducts of the various gadgets are what Boyer calls concepts. Some concepts happen to connect with inference systems in the brain in a way that makes recall and communication easy. Some concepts happen to trigger our emotional programs in particular ways. Some concepts happen to connect to our social mind. Some of them are represented in such a way that they soon become plausible and direct behavior. The ones that do all this are the religious ones we actually observe in human societies. Page 50. Boyer lists more than half a dozen distinct cognitive systems that feed effects into this recipe for religion. An agent detector, a memory manager, a cheater detector, a moral intuition generator, a sweet tooth for stories and storytelling, various alarm systems, and what I call the intentional stance. Any mind with this particular set of thinking tools and biases is bound to harbor something like a religion sooner or later, he claims. Patron and others offer largely concurring accounts, and the details are well worth exploring. But I am just going to sketch some of the big picture so that we can see the overall shape of the theory, not yet assess it for truth. It will take decades of research to secure any of this theory. But right now, we can get a sense of what the possibilities are, and hence what questions we ought to be trying to answer. 3. How nature deals with the problem of other minds. We find human faces in the moon, armies in the clouds, and, by a natural propensity, if not corrected by experience and reflection, ascribe malice and goodwill to everything that hurts or pleases us. David Hume, The Natural History of Religion. I saw you take his kiss. 'Tis true, O modesty, 'twas strictly kept. He thought me asleep. At least I knew he thought, I thought. He thought I slept. Coventry Patmore, The Kiss. The first thing we have to understand about human minds as suitable homes for religion is how our minds understand other minds. Everything that moves needs something like a mind to keep it out of harm's way and help it find the good things. Even a lowly clam, which tends to stay in one place, has one of the key features of a mind, a harm-avoiding retreat of its feeding foot into its shell when something alarming is detected. Any vibration or bump is apt to set it off, and probably most of these are harmless, but better safe than sorry is the clam's motto, the free-floating rationale of the clam's alarm system. More mobile animals have evolved more discriminating methods. In particular, they tend to have the ability to divide detected motion into the banal, the rustling of the leaves, the swaying of the seaweed, and the potentially vital, the animate motion or biological motion of another agent, another animal with a mind, who might be a predator or a prey or a mate or a rival conspecific. This makes economic sense, of course. If you startle at every motion you detect, you'll never find supper, and if you don't startle at the dangerous motions, you'll soon be somebody else's supper. This is another good trick, an evolutionary innovation, like eyesight itself or flight, that is so useful to so many different ways of life that it evolves over and over again in many different species. Sometimes this good trick can be too much of a good thing. Then we have what Justin Barrett, 2000, calls a hyperactive agent detection device, or HAD. This overshooting is not restricted to human beings. When your dog leaps up and growls when some snow falls off the eaves with a thud that rouses him from his nap, he is manifesting a false positive orienting response triggered by his HAD. Recent research on animal intelligence, Witten and Byrne, 1988-1997, Hauser, 2000, Sterlny, 2003, see also Dennett, 1996, has shown that some mammals and birds, and perhaps some other creatures as well, carry these agent discriminations into more sophisticated territory. Evidence shows that they not only distinguish the animate movers from the rest, but draw distinctions between the likely sorts of motions to anticipate from the animate ones. Will it attack me or flee? Will it move left or right? Will it back down if I threaten? Does it see me yet? Does it want to eat me, or would it prefer to go after my neighbor? These cleverer animal minds have discovered the further good trick of adopting the intentional stance. Dennett, 1971, 1983, 1987. They treat some other things in the world as agents with limited beliefs about the world, specific desires, and enough common sense to do the rational thing given those beliefs and desires. Once animals began adopting the intentional stance, something of an arms race ensued with ploy and counterploy, deceptive move and intelligent detection of deceptive move, carrying animal minds to greater subtlety and power. If you have ever tried to catch or trap a wild animal, you have some appreciation of the wiliness that has evolved. Clam digging, in contrast, is child's play. Clams have not evolved the intentional stance, though they do have simple hair-trigger hads. The utility of the intentional stance in describing and predicting animal behavior is undeniable, but that doesn't mean that the animals themselves are clued in about what they are doing. When a low-nesting bird leads the predator away from her nestlings by doing a distraction display, she is making a convincing sham of a broken wing, creating the tempting illusion of an easy supper for the observing predator, but she need not understand this clever ruse. She does need to understand the conditions of likely success, so that she can adjust her behavior the better to fit the variations encountered. But she no more needs to be aware of the deeper rationale for her actions than does the fledgling cuckoo when it pushes the rival eggs out of the nest in order to maximize the food it will get from its foster parents. Researchers have several other terms for the intentional stance. Some call it theory of mind. Premack and Woodruff, 1978, Leslie, 1987, Gopnik and Meltzoff, 1997. But there are problems with that formulation, so I'm going to stick with my more neutral terminology. Whenever an animal treats something as an agent, with beliefs and desires, with knowledge and goals, I say that it is adopting the intentional stance, or treating that thing as an intentional system. The intentional stance is a useful perspective for an animal to take in a hostile world. Strelny, 2003. Since there are things out there that may want it, and may have beliefs about where it is and where it is heading. Among the species that have evolved the intentional stance, there is considerable variation in sophistication. Faced with a threatening rival, many animals can make an informationally sensitive decision either to retreat or to call the other's bluff. But there is scant evidence that they have any sense of what they are doing or why. There is some controversial evidence that a chimpanzee can believe that another agent, a chimpanzee or a human being, say, knows that the food is in the box rather than in the basket. This is second-order intentionality, Dennett, 1983, involving beliefs about beliefs, or beliefs about desires, or desires about beliefs, etc. But there is no evidence, yet, that any non-human animal can want you to believe that it thinks you are hiding behind the tree on the left, not the right. Third-order intentionality. But even preschool children delight in playing games in which one child wants another to pretend not to know what the first child wants the other to believe. Fifth-order intentionality. You be the sheriff and ask me which way the robbers went. Whatever the situation is with non-human animals, and this is a topic of vigorous and hotly debated research, there is no doubt at all that normal human beings do not have to be taught how to conceive of the world as containing lots of agents who, like themselves, have beliefs and desires, as well as beliefs and desires about the beliefs and desires of others, and beliefs and desires about the beliefs and desires that others have about them, and so forth. This virtuoso use of the intentional stance comes naturally, and it has the effect of saturating the human environment with folk psychology, Dennett, 1981. We experience the world as not just full of moving human bodies, but of rememberers and forgetters, thinkers and hopers, and villains and dupes, and promise-breakers, and threateners, and allies, and enemies. Indeed, those human beings who find perceiving the world from this perspective difficult, though suffering from autism are the best-suited category, have a more significant disability than those who are born blind or deaf. Baron Cohen, 1995, Dunbar, 2004. So powerful is our innate urge to adopt the intentional stance that we have real difficulty turning it off when it is no longer appropriate. When somebody we love or even just know well dies, we suddenly are confronted with a major task of cognitive updating, revising all our habits of thought to fit a world with one less familiar intentional system in it. I wonder if she'd like, does she know I'm, oh look, this is something she always wanted. A considerable portion of the pain and confusion we suffer when confronting a death is caused by the frequent, even obsessive reminders that our intentional stance habits throw up at us like annoying pop-up ads, but much, much worse. We can't just delete the file in our memory banks, and besides, we wouldn't want to be able to do so. What keeps many habits in place is the pleasure we take from indulging in them. And so we dwell on them, drawn to them like a moth to a candle. We preserve relics and other reminders of the deceased persons and make images of them and tell stories about them to prolong these habits of mind even as they start to fade. But there is a problem. A corpse is a potent source of disease, and we have evolved a strong compensatory innate disgust mechanism to make us keep our distance. Pulled by longing and pushed back by disgust, we are in turmoil when we confront the corpse of a loved one. Small wonder that this crisis should play so central a role in the birth of religions everywhere.